You are listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Hey, good afternoon. This is Paula Lozano-Ostman. We're here live on The American Hour. We seem to be having a little bit of difficulty picking up some people on the phone here, so you'll have to bear with me while I try to get this going. Couple of program notes. Well, one really important one. We've got on Monday's show Joe Goldner, and he is running he's a candidate for Congressional District 20 in Florida, from what I understand. He's running against the DNC chairwoman. I believe her name is Debbie Wasserman Schultz. He is going to be on tomorrow from 12 noon to 1 p.m. Eastern. If you want to listen to him discuss domestic and foreign issues, live with Captain Matt Bruce, News Talk 820. And he's going to be talking, he's opposing the DNC's new chairman for the congressional seat. So he'll be on our show on Monday, and we'll be talking to him about that. We're going to be discussing critical issues on Monday at 4 o'clock here on our show with Mr. Goldner. So if you want to listen to that. If you bear with me for just a couple of seconds, I am going to try to see how I can get this moving, because it's just not happening for whatever reason. So if you just bear with me. Hey guys, how's it going?
Hey Paula, how are you doing?
I'm okay. For whatever reason, I was having difficulties, and I apologize.
That's A-okay. Well, for our listeners out there, this is Tom Garcia. I'm calling in from a remote location. I cannot tell you where I am located. It's a secret. Just flew in from Ecuador and got in late today because of weather down in Miami. So I'm having to broadcast from my secret remote location. And so it's going to be a little noisier than usual. And that's it. So in any case, that's what's going on today, but we've got stuff to talk about, and we're glad that you joined in. Paula, how was, I know the last couple of days you've been broadcasting without me. You had Michael Cutler on, let's see, was it yesterday?
Yesterday.
Yes.
Very good.
Yeah,
Dick,
and then
Dick Barenbeck.
I didn't hear the whole thing, but Dick Barenbeck, I hear your voice, and it sounds like maybe you joined in on the show yesterday.
Yes, I did. Mr. Cutler is very interesting.
Yeah, he is. Smart guy. And he just got quoted in the Washington Times for something that he said about Poland. And Poland is jumping in line. You know, as the president's doing his whirlwind tour around Europe and doing his glad handing while we're, you know, dealing with tornadoes and other crises at home, he's out pontificating and glad handing and getting slapped on the back and slapping people on the back. And when he got to Poland, they put a lot of pressure on him to give the Poles visa waivers. In other words, we want to, you know, be sure who's coming into our country. And when you apply for a visa, and Michael Cutler will tell you all about this, it helps track who's coming in and what they're doing. And these visa waivers are a way to expedite being able to come to this country. You just say, I want a waiver. Okay, there's your waiver. Then you just show up, and you don't need a waiver or a visa. And so everybody in the world is clamoring to get into this country. And, of course, you know what's going to happen. A lot of people are going to come to the country. And they're on a visa waiver, so they didn't need a visa. And then guess what? They never go home. I mean, some will. But, hey, what's so hard about getting a visa if you're just going to go on vacation? There's plenty of countries that we as Americans have to get visas for. But But in any case, that's, I'm not going to go into details because I didn't read the article in the Washington Times, but they did quote him on that, his comments on why it's a bad idea giving away so many visa waivers. So if you want to Google that out there, anybody, Michael Cutler, who filled in for me yesterday and was on the show back on Monday, and he just makes the rounds. He's a really sharp guy, great on a variety, whole variety of different subjects, and he's really worth listening to. So I guess that's probably what you found out, didn't you, Dick?
Yes, yes. He's very. Unfortunately, we got sidetracked on some issues, and we couldn't really get into what he wanted to talk about. But he is very interesting, and I believe he's on tonight at 7, and I plan on catching his show.
Okay, good. Very good. So
you had
go ahead, Dick.
You had talked a little bit about the president going from country to country and patting people on the back and getting people to pat him on the back. I actually enjoy his trips when he's traveling the world because he never ceases to amaze me how he can make a fool of himself.
Okay, good. Yeah, you're right, absolutely right about that. Well, I've been, you know, like I said, out of town the last couple of days, so tell us what you saw him do recently that made a fool out of him.
Well, when you toast the Queen, you raise your glass and say, "To the Queen, long live the Queen." That is where it starts and that's where it ends. And you don't talk when they are playing their national anthem and making some sort of a speech to the Queen. It shows you're inept.
Yeah, well, and, you know, socially, he's very inept socially. He doesn't know the social graces involved in, you know, proper etiquette. In and you know, guess what? You know, not all of us would know those things. I had a book when I was at the Naval Academy, a pretty thick book, and the name of that book was Naval Etiquette. Everything you needed to know about, you know, being a naval officer and situations and how to handle those situations properly. So apparently nobody handed him the presidential etiquette book, or maybe they did and he just didn't read it.
Well, maybe they should put it on a teleprompter for him.
Well, then he'll read it, but he'll read it to us, and it won't sink in. I don't know that anything he reads to us sinks in, because he reads different things. He changes the story all the time. In fact, I was looking at an article recently that was saying a flashback to March, when the president said, "We're going into Libya to create a no-fly zone for humanitarian purposes. We'll be there for days, not weeks." Oh, it's turned into not days, not weeks, but months. And who knows, it's going to turn into years? I think this is the first president to have us in three wars at one time. And somebody said to me yesterday, "Well, it's NATO that's in there now, Tom." Well, we are NATO. We do, I don't want to say we're doing the bulk of the flying, but we're doing our share of flying. And who is the NATO commander? A U.S. general. So it's still us running the show, just we're wearing a different hat saying, "Oh, we're NATO now." And I couldn't believe how many people think that the United Nations, if the United Nations says, "Hey, there's a problem over here and we're authorizing the use of force," that then our president can just go do that, even if it's a good cause. You know what I'm saying? It's like the United Nations can authorize our president to do stuff, and yet the Congress has no say in it? Ridiculous. Absolutely ludicrous. So, there's our little flashback to him reading a teleprompter. "We'll be there for days, not weeks." Oops, things change. Now, this is the danger of this gentleman and why Israel should pay no heed to what he says they should be doing in their negotiations. Because when he says, "Don't worry, we got your back, go ahead and give all that land back to Jordan and Syria and Egypt, and then you can, you know, negotiate your way back into something a little more reasonable, but we got your back." Well, just like we're only going to be in Libya for days, not weeks. Oops, well, things change. See, I've heard that in the business world. Oops, sorry, things change. We promised you this, but things change. Guantanamo Bay, promise I'll close that in 1 year. Oops, things change. Patriot Act, got to get rid of that. Oops, things change. I just signed it yesterday. And the list goes on and on. You know, oh, well, we got to get out of Iraq within, remember he said he had a plan, I think it was something like 18 months, 15 months. Plan when he was a candidate, "I can get us out of Iraq in 15 months. Let's see, it's been 3 years and we're still there. Yes, we are pulling out. We're gradually getting out, but we're still there. So him and his all his great ideals are not reality. And that's the danger of this president. He never talks about anything that has anything to do with reality. His proposals are rooted in a wish list that is not much different than a little five-year-old child, what they wish for Christmas or their birthday. So, in fact, some kids have much more realistic expectations of what they're going to get as a gift, possibly, than this guy does of what he can actually accomplish. All right, there's my time read for the day. Paula.
I was reading the paper today, or yesterday, and somebody was referring to the president as a man-child, and it fits beautifully.
It does. It just doesn't have any real experience doing anything of real value. I mean, being a community agitator, he would have been great to take over the reins of, say, Acorn or some such thing, but to be president of the country, the United States of America, just because you did some community agitating? I don't think so. Yeah.
He's all done being president and write a book on all of the errors that he made and how he didn't follow decorum meeting with other dignitaries. Kind of a comical book, you know, a funny book.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody could come up with that, and it'd be definitely worth reading. Maybe even somebody could just make a video and clip, put all his faux pas together. Because, you know, people have done that about George Bush, and people just, you know, here's what's interesting. People that didn't like George Bush just hated him with a vile, vile hatred. Yet, I see a lot of people that, I hate to say it, but we do Obama bash on this show a little bit, but we deal with the facts. Here's what the president said. You know, 2 months ago, here's what he's saying today. They don't jive, you know, and those kind of things. We stick with the facts and the way he has handled himself in his office. We respect the office, and we do not, talk on the show with any kind of vile hatred about any people, no matter how bad they're doing in their elected office, et cetera. So we make fun of people a little bit. There's no big deal there, but boy, I just couldn't believe that. And even to this day, I run into people now that just even say the word George Bush, or you don't have to say it, they'll bring it up, and man, they just, the hatred that is there, I don't know. I don't quite get it. I guess it's just a certain type of person, and it almost makes me think that a certain type of person that could be a liberal is the same kind of person that can have that kind of hatred and just not ever be able to let go of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, you know, that's just me. That's just my casual observance of people in general. Mm-hmm. But now, Paula, I know you've been kind of scouring the news a little bit and seeing what's going on. And like I said, I didn't really have much time to do that very, very briefly. But did anything jump out at you yesterday or today?
Well, I wanted to bring to everyone's attention our friend Matt Falconer posted something. I mean, you're going on about Mr. Obama and whatnot. And last week, you know, you had been talking about the SunRail program down in Florida.
Right, absolutely.
Well, on Matt Falconer's Facebook page, he posted something, and I thought it was funny. He said that when Rick Scott spoke in the villages yesterday, everyone seated in the audience wore the attached Kill SunRail sticker except for three people. And it's a SunRail. It's the SunRail, you know, with the slash in the circle in it. No SunRail. So he asked the governor after if he saw all the Kill SunRail stickers, and the governor said he did. So Matt said to him, the only three people who refused to wear them had Obama stickers on. And the governor laughed.
That's very good. Yeah, I've heard mixed predictions about what the governor's going to do about SunRail, but it's not a winning proposition whatsoever. And we had a discussion going on, and it was on Matt's Facebook page, and one of the liberal losers that was on there talking about, well, it's going to create jobs, it's going to do this, it's going to do that. Yeah, it's going to create jobs at taxpayer expense, and then once it's there, it's not going to certainly not going to pay for itself. Here's the bottom line: you have to understand this. No public transportation pays for itself. None, zero in the world. High speed rails all over the world, and people travel in Europe, and I've traveled in Europe, and you go, wow, this is fantastic. It's all subsidized by the government. So the question Is it worth subsidizing? And in the case of Sunreal, the answer is no. It will be highly underutilized. It's even worse in terms of what ridership is going to be and what it's capable of than, say, Tri-Rail down in the south. It just goes north-south right along the I-95 corridor. And there was some, cronyism, I don't know what you want to call it, but politicking going on as to where the stops would be. And, of course, state legislators were, you know, doing what they could to appease the folks in their districts if the Sunrail was going to be anywhere near it. So some of the stops are not really good quality, logical stops for the Sunrail. But anyway, this gentleman at some point, I can't remember who said something about, you know, I just believe that Sunrail is not good for the taxpayer, not good for us, and I can't support it in good faith or whatever. And he made some comment, and I said, you know what, it's about integrity. It's having the integrity to do what's right. Just because you want to create some jobs and some short-term, you know, work effort there. So anyway, he said, well, where's your integrity on NASA? You know, that boondoggle. He called NASA a boondoggle, so I responded by saying, you just lost all credibility, all credibility. You clearly know absolutely nothing about what NASA does and what NASA has done for our country over the years. So that was the last. I didn't even look back. I didn't even want to see what this guy would even attempt. Right? You know, it's amazing when liberals don't like something. They'll call it a name, and they'll deride it, but they'll never give any stats, any statistics, any facts. Matt Falconer will give you all the stats and numbers on Sunrail and why it's a huge money loser and will be even worse in the future. He's got numbers to support all of that. He's done analysis. There are a couple other people. Roger Sheely, who ran for office over in Brevard County, state legislator, he had all the numbers. A fantastic presentation. I actually had him send me a copy of his presentation, or at least the paper on it, so that I could talk about it, you know, reasonably, even though I was running for Congress, not a state level, but I wanted to have the facts. These guys come out with facts. Liberals never come up with numbers and facts and you know, studies and anything else like that. They just call it a name and go, it's a waste of time, and prove it to me. Well, they never can. So it's just, take those folks with a grain of salt, and that grain of salt is they don't stand on substance.
When I see our government wanting to get into we'll call it a business, such as Sunrail. I can't think of any programs that our government is in, both at the county, state, and federal level, that is a money-making proposition. It is always supported by the taxpayers because they don't bring enough money in. If it was a money-making proposition, some railroad would run it and operate it and make money off of it. They don't run it because it's a losing situation. But our government will jump in with both feet and say, oh, no, we're going to make an awful lot of money on this. Right. Money off of the taxpayers.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what you guys are into for your tolls down there. But Matt had also posted a piece yesterday as well. Wednesday. I'm sorry. He said the toll road agency, I guess in your region, is $2.3 billion in debt, and they want to borrow another $1.8 billion. And he asked, you know, people in general, do you think we should go deeper into debt and double tolls again? You know?
Right. Yeah. That's exactly it. Build these roads and they put tolls on them, but then they don't get utilized as much. So that just goes to show you, if somebody's not willing to spend 50 cents to drive down a road that's going to get them there quicker, they'd rather take the congested road. Are they going to pay $25 to get on a train or 10 or 15 bucks? I mean, it's not going to happen. So the reality is this, and then the tolls. Now, see, here's an interesting proposition on the whole thing. Part of what they're going to use to pay for Sunrail is going to be the taxes and toll, the taxes on gas and the tolls that are brought in from the cars driving. If Sunrail would actually work, then there's going to be less gasoline purchased, so less tax money there, and there'll be less tolls being paid because people aren't in their cars on the highway.
Right.
So what they're relying on, so if you could just use the extreme, and mathematicians and you know, do this all the time, what if we could go to the extreme? Everybody stop driving cars and just rode the train, as if that would get everybody where they need to go, but just as an extreme. There would be no money from all those tolls to pay for the SunRail, except for the money that's being paid. So in other words, now to actually pay for SunRail, even get it close so that the government isn't spending billions, or, well, it'd be more like, you know, maybe $100 million every year to cover it, then, you know, the people you're relying on are the exact people that you're trying to get rid of, car drivers. And a study was done up in the New York area of the bridges and the tolls, et cetera, that if we were able to get mass transit to the point where people stopped using the bridges and the toll roads in New York, they could not afford the mass transit. So it's a kind of a combo thing. You have to look at it and say, okay, how much mass transit will people actually use? And what can toll that pricing and the tolls and everything, or the tolls from the roads and bridges and everything else, what will that support? And in South Florida and in Central Florida, it's not some expensive light rail system. It's just not going to work. So that's exactly what, you know, Matt is pointing out, that it's not only are we saying we're going to rely on tolls to help pay for supporting SunRail, but the toll system itself, just for paying for the roads and maintaining the toll system itself, is in debt, severely in debt. So, yeah, it's a losing proposition. And who gets hurt in the end is the taxpayer. And everybody,
right.
We're talking every single person. It's not just the rich or the corporations. It's the average citizen ultimately gets hurt.
Well, what he said was that the road includes and I hope he's got his numbers right, because he said a 6,000-foot bridge so the turtles can cross underneath it. I've never heard of such a thing.
Oh yeah, we're really proud of our turtles here in our sea turtles, and but the problem is over there in Central Florida, we're not by the ocean. Our turtles that actually lay eggs down along the in the beaches are highly protected, and they put up stakes and ribbons and everything, so you know don't walk there, etc. And there are all kinds of groups that go out during the egg laying season and monitor and rope off and take care of that stuff. So the turtles he must be talking about in Central Florida are the ones that are coming out of the lakes. So those are just, you know, I don't know if they're endangered anyway.
That comment, but, you know.
Yeah. Well,
I have written letters to all of our state officials regarding SunRail. And the issue I was pointing out to them is, number one, it's not high-speed rail. Don't call it high-speed. It goes slower than an Amtrak train. Number two, you have to drive your car to get to the train. Then when you get there, you sit and wait for the train. When you get to where you're going on the train, you have to have another car or a taxi or a bus to get to where you're going.
Right.
Now, in all the time it's going to take you to drive to the depot, park your car, wait for the train, you can take your car and drive there in half the time.
Absolutely.
Are you going to take the train or are you going to take your car?
Yeah. Now, a lot of it depends on location. There are places in the country where it works fine because, for example, when I go down to the airport and I take the train, I don't need a car once I get to the airport. But if I were going anywhere else along there, yes, somebody would have to come pick me up. I'd have to take a bus. And the bus systems in Florida aren't very good. And I asked one of our state legislators back when this was all a big controversy. I said, well, what are you going to do to improve the bus system in the Orlando area so that it's more the SunRail is more usable? And he said, well, hopefully we'll be able to do something about that. So they don't even have a plan. You know what? I don't want you spending my money till you have a plan and you can lay it out there and show me how this is all going to work. But they don't. And finally, I would say that, and I think I said this when Matt was on the show like a week or two ago, that I asked some of our legislators, did you ever consider or look at the feasibility? I know it's feasible, but the cost of putting a upper deck on the I-4 corridor that's going through Orlando. That's really where the whole root of the problem is. I-4 gets jammed up every morning, every afternoon, and they say it would be astronomical price to expand it by just one lane because they've expanded it so many times over the years. Well, put a deck on it. How much would that cost? And once the deck is there, there's a maintenance cost to it, but man, talk about freeing up congestion. And do they consider it? I got stairs like, you know, deer in the headlight. No. Why not? It would probably be it would certainly be cheaper than widening it, because that's, you're talking about all kinds of land you got to buy up and right of ways and everything else. And as far as the train goes, maybe the initial production or building of the light rail, the SunRail system, might be less, but how about the long-term operating that? Oh, my gosh. You know, Americans like their independence and freedom, whether they're driving a car that burns gas, diesel, electric, or riding a motorcycle that doesn't even burn that much gas. We like to have the ability to go where we want to go, when we want to go. That's called liberty and freedom that a lot of people in other countries just don't have. I had somebody ask me, I was having to take a cab to get around in Lima the other day, and somebody asked me, the cab driver, I guess it was, said, yeah, it was the cab driver. He said, do you have a car? And I said, in Florida? Yeah, I own a car in Florida. I mean, you know, because a lot of people don't own cars in some of these countries, and that's why taxi cabs, they're inexpensive, quite honestly, because there's so many of them. And that's how a primary means for a lot of people get around. There are people that go their entire lifetime never owning a car and just taking cabs and occasionally buses. I mean, they have all kinds of bus systems there. They've got government bus systems. They've got private bus systems. You can get a license and you're not working for the government, but just go out there and transport people around on different routes. There's lots of these sort of private buses running all over the place. So that's, you know, that's their culture, and that's, but it's not going to fit into our culture today. Now, we can start shifting, but we can't just make it happen overnight. And that's what some people want to do. They want to make it happen overnight. Let's make gas so expensive that people just can't afford it. They'll have to ride the train. They'll have to take the bus. Well, is it a bus system and a train system that will actually get the masses to where they need to go? No, it's not. So the final argument for a SunRail is, well, let's start making the moves and the steps to get there. Okay, I'd be willing to do that if you can lay out a reasonable cost. CSX is the train company that's going to would be managing and building and running the SunRail. Well, their cost estimates, and Matt's brought this up before many times, their cost estimates for TriRail were severely underestimated. So whatever they've estimated, did our state legislators get an outside independent authority to come in and give us some estimates on what it's more likely going to be for the cost structure? No, they relied on CSX, who has a vested interest in getting this contract. So of course they're going to totally underbid the cost, knowing that Florida will fall for it once again. Gee, costs are overrunning and it costs a lot more to operate. Well, sorry about that, but just keep paying us. So they didn't do that, and they don't have a plan for other forms of transit outside of the train. Just as you brought up, Dick, how do you get from one place to the next if you don't have a car? You're talking the stop that was going to be the Disneyland stop was going to stop 8 miles from Disney. There were going to be buses that provided by, I suppose, Disney to get its employees back and forth, but you, the consumer, you, the constituent, you, the vacationer, are going to have to take a cab, and you know what it is in the U.S., 8 miles to go in a cab could be, you know, $20-$25. Mm-hmm. And how much did you already pay for your ticket? And maybe you're got your whole family with you because you're on vacation. Oh, my gosh. It'd be better to rent a car at the airport, you know, or wherever.
Let me ask a question, something I'm not too sure of, because I'm not a college graduate. But I hear our power companies saying about power shortages. We don't have enough electricity. At times in the summertime, everybody's running air conditioning, the refrigerators, everything else, and there's a power shortage. So they tell us. Now they tell us, you got to have an electric car. How does the car get its electricity? You plug it in. Another power shortage. But that's okay. We can burn more coal. Now, is somebody in Washington stupid, or am I the stupid one?
No, you're absolutely right. We would need a lot more coal. Now, see, here's what they want to try and convince us, because they're deluded, but they want to try and convince us that they can do, and that is, well, we're going to find more alternative energy sources to provide that electricity, so you won't need the coal. Well, I can tell you this right now. One of the things that the Obama administration was promoting was biomass. Now, biomass sounds really cool, doesn't it? Oh, that sounds like very environmentally friendly, and it's going to solve our problems. Biomass. And biomass is growing. Biomass, I'll tell you what biomass is. It's pretty much trash. Now, what does burning trash do? It doesn't put off quite the kind of what do you want to call it, you know, carbon and hydrogen and other things like that, pollutants that coal would do, but coal produces per pound so much more energy. Okay, so biomass. It's wood. It could be leftover wood, wood chips, wood shavings from the lumber industry, trees that have been cut down. You know, all that stuff can be used. But guess what all of that stuff burning anything like that does? It puts carbon, CO2, into the atmosphere. They're so concerned about. So I don't think there's a conspiracy here, but I do think if we really drove the direction, and first of all, how much trash is there? There's a finite amount of trash to be burned. And when I say trash, it's not like what you're necessarily putting into your trash can in the kitchen, but stuff that is of a carbon-based product that can be burned. As I said, most of it's wood, but there are other things. You know, there can be papers and you know, I don't know what else. But in any case, and there can be actually like some old, you know, some food products, grain products that have not been used or spoiled or, you know, can be thrown into that mix. But in any case, how much? There's a finite amount, and since it puts off so much carbon when it is burned, oh, we're going to have a carbon tax. So we're all thinking, hey, we're going to biomass, and that's going to produce more electricity, except, well, it puts off a lot of carbon, and there's this new carbon tax with cap and trade, so costs are going to go up, 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 and that's really, you know, what's driving all of this. So, and then finally, the other thing, and I think this is the most important thing, we get almost all of our lithium, in fact, I think we get all of our lithium from countries like Bolivia, and Bolivia is the main producer of the lithium that we use for our lithium ion batteries that go into cars. So instead of being dependent on the Middle East for oil, we're going to be dependent on a Marxist nation for batteries. So all of this, yeah, we got to get off of foreign energy dependence. We won't. If we went to all electric cars tomorrow, we would be wholly dependent on Bolivia. Now, there's some other countries that can produce lithium in fairly large amount. One would be Chile, and they've kind of started leaning the Marxist direction a little bit more of the socialist, but they've always kind of been that way. And then we've got Russia. They're a good friend of ours, aren't they? They're always stabbing us in the back. Russia can produce a lot of lithium if it wanted to. So, but in the U.S., we don't have any significant supply of lithium. So we're going to be dependent on somebody else for our green electric cars that are going to burn coal and biomass, which all put off lots of carbon. It doesn't sound so green to me, actually.
We are a mobile society. Most families have members of families in other states. I'm in Florida. I have family members in Minnesota. When I go up to visit them in my gasoline car, it takes me 2 days. I drive 12 hours a day. We look for a hotel, have dinner, go to sleep, get up, drive another 12 hours to get there. In my gasoline car, roughly 1,500 miles. How long is it going to take me to make that trip in my electric car?
Well, electric cars of today, and this is something I talked about on the show, one of the shows, we're getting to the point where we're reaching a higher rapid capability of charging. Right now, it wouldn't work. You could drive for about what I was talking about on the show, about 6 hours, so whatever that would give you, with a generator that is running, so like a home generator and a fairly large one running to recharge the batteries, but you're still going to be depleting. I think around a 1,000-watt generator right now would keep you running for 6 hours before you got to the point where you're just out of juice. And I don't remember what the recharge time is for batteries, but eventually we'll have, and I've already read about these rapid charge, where you could charge the batteries in about an hour. But you're talking, you need the right connectors to do that. Now, if you had a built-in generator, so in other words, no gasoline motor, just a generator, the generator won't power the car. Actually, the generator could power the motor that is the electric motor that is driving the car, but it wouldn't be as efficient as having all those batteries charged up. So with the rapid charge, my guess is you could drive 12 hours continuous at about 65 miles an hour and maintain a charge the whole way, but that's on down the road. I don't see that happening for 5, 6, 10 years. even though the technology is almost there, to get it into production. So you would be able
My
to.
My God, Tom, at my age, I'll be dead by then.
Well, you'll still be with us, Dick, but the other thing is this. What kind of generator would you need to do that rapid charge? You're going to be burning fuel in a generator, and what kind of fuel? How many gallons? I don't know. I haven't looked at the numbers. I know that on a couple gallons, a pretty heavy-duty generator, I believe, can run, you know, for like 12 hours. So you'd burn a couple gallons of gas, and then when you'd get wherever, you'd plug it in for the night, and it'd charge up, and they'd charge you, you know, whatever the electricity costs. But electricity costs could be so high by that point, if we keep going down this got-to-be greeny road, that it costs you as much as the gas is today. And so we could look back, I could see 10, 15 years from now and go, yeah, I got my electric car, and I'm still paying as much as I used to pay, but I'm saving the planet. That's the main thing, except for all that coal and biofuel that's burning. You're absolutely right. But today, no, it would take you – you couldn't do that. You couldn't do that drive in an electric car today. It'd take you 2 weeks.
I think they're only looking right now, today, at roughly 50 to 60 miles on a charge.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think there's some of these cars that are doing just that. Like, I think the Chevy Bolt has a generator in it that if you had it running from the beginning, from the get-go, you could get like 120 miles. What I was talking about on the one show, not having a little generator, but a fairly large generator that would probably have to go either in the bed of a truck or you'd be pulling it behind you on a little flatbed.
Maybe I could put it in my 58 Oldsmobile.
Yeah. Well, I calculated, and there are people – yeah, there you go. There are people on the Internet. You can Google it. You can find out. Lots of people talk about it. People are actually doing it. But some of the estimates, and I did my own calculation, that you could go about 240 miles with a 1,000-watt generator providing. Here's what happens. To drive about 65 miles an hour, and it all depends on the weight of the vehicle and what kind of engine, you know, electric motor and the batteries, et cetera. But I think on a Prius-sized vehicle, to go 65 miles an hour is eating up, let's see, I think 80 watts per I don't remember if it was 80 watts per hour. Or maybe per minute or whatever. But the charge rate, you could, with a heavy duty, you know, like around a 1,000-watt generator, you could be producing about 60 or so. So you were somewhere, and I don't have the numbers with me right here, but I came up with 18. You're an 18-watt deficit, and that over the course of 6 hours, that would be enough to deplete the battery. So that's where I came up with the 6 hours and about 240 miles. Somewhere around in that range, 220, 240, 250, whatever. But so you get the picture. So, yeah, even if you did that today with the existing batteries, you can only get so far. And my comment on the show, which got some negative comments from people, was you could drive around town all day, and you could. Who gets in their car and says, I got errands to run, stores to go to, kids to pick up, et cetera, and drives for 6 hours straight? No, you drive to the grocery store and you go in and you shop and you come back out and then you go to the next store. Then you go pick up the kids or drop the kids off or go do, you know, a post office, go to the bank. Every time you stop, if that generator is running, and some of these generators are very, very quiet now, that generator is still running while you're in shopping. You come back out and the vehicle is, you know, depending on how long you were in there, gotten a bit of a recharge, and that'll keep you going all day long. And you're just driving around in town most of the time, so yeah, there's stop and go. But you literally could spend your day driving with a car with a generator, and there are people doing it, and they're not having to stop and recharge, and they may very well drive more than 100 miles, 150 miles during the course of the day, and they're able to do that in an electric car. But it is. You are right, Dick. It's highly inconvenient. I couldn't do it right now unless I set up a system like that. I don't have the money to go buy a vehicle like that and set up a system just so I can drive all the way down to, you know, Miami Airport and then a few days later drive all the way back. There's no electric car right now that will do that for me. I'd have to modify something myself. That's too expensive, too much work, and it's just not going to happen, not anytime soon. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, these are all good things to talk about, and I try to make it clear I'm never opposed to trying to come up with ways to, reduce our dependence on any kind of foreign substance. you know, whether it's the lithium or the oil or anything that we use for getting around, I'd like to see a lot more manufacturing at home. So, and as far as the environment goes, absolutely, I'm all for a clean environment. But we can't make it happen overnight. Now, I talk about Brazil. I've talked about Brazil in the past where they've been working for, I think it's 25 years now, on increasing their production of, they call it ethanol, we call it ethanol. It's really alcohol, but it is a form of ethanol. And when you listen to the media, the TV and anybody else talk about it, you get the impression that 80% of their fuel is this cane sugar ethanol. It's not. 80% of their fuel is petroleum, just like we use. Only 20%. It's taken them 25 years to get to the point where 20% of their fuel supply that goes into cars and vehicles in Brazil is this cane sugar ethanol. 25 years it took them to get that. And they have been aggressive about pushing this and making this a reality. So 20% is nothing to snicker at. No, that's great. But people have to realize 25 years. Yeah, we could do it faster if we really wanted to, but it would just be very, very expensive. And so here's a country that is not a wealthy, wealthy country. That's not something that they could do overnight. They've had to work into it. There you go, 25 years. Good. I think we should have been doing stuff like that as well in a smart way, not corn ethanol. That's a huge mistake, but we should have been doing things like that, and we haven't. And we haven't had leaders that have tried to lead in that regard to drive us in some different directions other than mandating you will start using ethanol and you will use U.S. you know, corn grain ethanol, which is expensive to produce and pollutes just as much as gasoline and gives you less power per gallon. So there you have it. Wow, we're mandated to have ethanol so we can save the planet, except it doesn't save the planet at all. It's worse than the planet. It taps into the food supply. We're not benefiting from it, and there's government mandating something instead of let's have some leaders step up and talk about some good options and make some good choices for a change instead of just shoving something down our throat. But we haven't done that.
I am all for not polluting our planet and changing things where there is real pollution, not some made-up pollution by somebody that has an investment or ulterior motive. I was talking to somebody not too long ago about oil, and they were all for, we got to get away from oil, we got to quit using oil. And I said, I want you to think about oil. And I started naming off things that they won't have anymore if we get away from oil. Throw your cell phone away because you can't make one. It's made of plastic. That's oil. Take the tires off of your cars because they're made with oil. Throw your TV away. That's made with oil. Anything plastic in your house, get rid of it. Throw your computer away because it's made with oil. And they just sat there with their mouth open looking, thinking, I didn't realize all that stuff.
Yeah.
I said, oil is not just gasoline in your car.
Think about what gasoline has done for this nation and for the world. It's propelled us into the future. I mean, I still marvel at some of the airplanes, all of the airplanes that I've flown. But, you know, here I am flying. Today it was a 757 coming back from Ecuador. Thunderstorms, I'm looking on this radar and scoping out, you know, where the cells are, and we're getting vectored around by air traffic control. But at the same time, they don't see everything that's out there weather-wise. So we're dodging stuff. We're coming in and landing. And just, it's still, I don't know, it still gives me a, that's why I like being an airline pilot. It gives me sort of a little a shiver up my back sometimes when I get out of the cockpit and look back and see all these people that I just flew all that way to a whole nother hemisphere. And they get to, whatever it is, a lot of, because of being in, you know, Florida, we have a lot of people that come on vacation and specifically to go to Disney World. Quite honestly,
sure.
And a lot of kids getting off, but you know, I see missionaries getting on and going down south and transporting these people. I just think, you know, this is such a cool thing. But in order to make this work, in order to give people this kind of mobility to get around the planet, it takes petroleum, it takes fuel, and of course we use kerosene, a form of kerosene, but that comes from oil, and. We couldn't be like this. So there are the extremists that would like to just see us all living in caves or huts and never go anywhere and do anything. Hey, you know what I say to those people? Go do it, please. Please go do it. But the rest of us, like the freedom and liberty, we need to understand, okay, there's some people say, well, it's excessive. Well, that's your view on it. That's not mine. You know, as long as we live within our means, hey, people save, there are people, plenty of people that save up for years to then go on a really nice vacation. And they have that ability in this on this planet. But solar isn't going to fly those airplanes. Solar panels aren't going to do it. And as much as I love solar, I do love solar. I like solar. But it's also too expensive. I'd like to put them in my house right now. Can't afford them, those panels. So there are things that are just take time to evolve. It's called evolution. It's going to take time for some of these things to evolve. But, you know, spiting ourselves and tying our hands economically won't speed them up. It just won't do it.
Mm-hmm. When I moved down to Florida, of course, my home has a pool. That was one of my requirements. I would not buy a house without a pool. And it's a larger pool than what most homes have. My pool is 8 foot deep, which is pretty deep for the pools in this area. Anyway, I was looking for a way to heat that pool. And I wanted to look at solar power, which I did. And I got their costs, and then I looked at a propane heater. And in talking to the man with the propane heater, I told him I was looking at a solar panel to heat my pool. And his comment was, yes, it'll be a lot cheaper, but I want to warn you about something. The panels, the solar panels, the solar heater will only raise your pool 10 degrees above the outside temperature. So if it's 60 degrees outside, my solar heater is going to get my pool to 70. Folks, I don't swim in 70-degree water anymore. I did when I was 14 years old. Not anymore. And I went back to the solar store, and I said, if I buy this and I put this in my pool, heat my pool with it, how warm will it get my water? He said 10 degrees over the outside temperature.
Yeah.
Why would I want to heat my pool to 70 when I can't swim in it?
Well, now what year was this, Dick, that you did this, you looked into this?
That would have been 8 years ago.
Okay. Believe it or not, in eight years, the last 10 years, solar panels have come quite a long way. Now, I don't know that number has changed, but I do know they're much more effective and efficient than they used to be in terms of heating the water. But I will tell you this. I do have a pool, and it because the pool area is screened in, it never gets very warm. Toward the end of July and into August, it's warm enough for me, like you. I'm a sissy. It's warm. No, you're not. I'm not going to call you a sissy, but I'll say that I'm a sissy when it comes to the water. I don't want
to
go into
water,
anything.
I'm a sissy, Tom.
Okay. Now, I don't want to go into anything that's less than 80 degrees. And I only get about a month and a half, and here I am in South Florida with a south-facing pool. The pool gets sun all day long. So for somebody like me, where the temperature outside from, let's say, maybe as early as February, but definitely by March, is in the 80s, all the way through, you know, the end of October, that I could have 90-degree water for that long a time. So it would absolutely be. But I know what you're saying. There are limitations on it. But I do know this. I talked with two different solar panel companies, up in the Orlando area about a year ago. And they said they've got panels now that, depending on your home, and you know, newer homes tend to be a little better insulated and some other things and different wiring, et cetera. But they said you could actually achieve a 75% cost saving on your electric bill. 75%. I think that's pretty big of, you know, and they're saying all the electricity that you use in your house. So I think the panels have come a long way, but you're right, there are limitations still. And I think that we may see some more increases over the years to the point where if you decide to get another pool, Dick, maybe those panels will be able to, say, 10 years from now, heat your pool up 20 degrees over the outside, and then it would be worth it to you, right?
Yeah, I'm like you. My pool is on the south side of the house, and one portion of my roof, a big portion of my roof, also faces south. So if I did have solar panels, they would get an awful lot of sunshine.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
but
and that's just my own personal issue.
Yeah.
Now, if you have kids, like you were saying, Yeah, the screening really cuts down on the water, because there are people who are in the neighborhood that don't have a screened-in pool, and their pool is always warmer. In fact, the clubhouse pool here, if you know, when my kids were younger and they'd come to visit, we would go over to the clubhouse pool, and it was always at least 5 degrees warmer than my pool. So, yeah, that screening kind of affects things. But in any case, I like solar, and I do like this. Paula, you and I have talked about this. The big wind turbines that they're putting out in the water, off the coast.
Offshore wind.
I like that. Now, I think there are probably going to be some people that go, oh, it's an eyesore. I don't like seeing that. Well, I don't know. I don't think I'd mind seeing that, quite honestly. And I don't know how far out they have to be or how far out they can be, et cetera. And it's obviously going to depend on the depth of the bottom of the ocean there for where you're trying to put it in. I don't know that they can float. I think they got to be anchored. But and the other problem in a place like down in Florida is the hurricane season. I don't know how they'd be affected. I don't know if being having a base that goes way down in the water helps keep it secure, whereas on land there's a concern of those things starting to blow around. We've seen telephone poles and other things blow around. So I don't know the actual security of those things, but to me it seems like offshore, having been, you know, in the Navy and living near the ocean, whether it be the East or West Coast, there's almost always wind blowing out there, always. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me it would be a great source for energy. I just don't know what the cost. Do you have any idea what the cost is to put a wind turbine offshore?
No, I'm not privy to, because it all depends on what's going on. But I know recently that Google and other investors want to build a 350-mile-long undersea cable off the Atlantic coast. While another company called Tres Amigas, they want to create a 22-square-mile superconductor superstation to synchronize the nation's three major electrical grids, because the country becomes more and more energy hungry. The country needs more generating capacity, and most Americans are resistant to new projects near cities and suburbs, and the newer plants need to be placed far away from population centers to win approval. Google's support for the Atlantic Wind Connection, it could be a good public relations move for a company that relies on energy, you know, sucking data centers to run its core business. Google has invested so far a total of $400 million in clean energy products alone. And it says pursuing the projects both because they make good business sense and because they make the company more environmentally responsible. The Atlantic Winds Connection project is still at an early stage, and no one knows if Google and its co-investors can actually pull it off. Here in Massachusetts, even though it's taken 10 years to get where we are, Cape Wind still, I don't believe, has actually cleared that hurdle. I am going to a conference next Wednesday in Cambridge, you know, to understand the depth of Cape Wind and offshore wind and feasibility and cost and whatnot. It runs into the hundreds of millions of dollars, and it stems from, you know, putting the cable out there and how, you know, how far out you can go. And then you've got to go through, you know, all the studies where, you know, yeah, is it feasible? Is it okay to put it out there? How do people feel about it? How does it affect the fishing waters? There's so much.
Yeah, a lot of it. So you know what, the real point, I think, of this discussion is there's some great ideas out there. They're things that I like, but they just can't happen overnight. There's research has to be done and work on this. And to tie our hands in the meantime, I think, is a huge mistake. The only downside to this is that what I'm talking about is don't tie our hands economically. Unfortunately, the history of our country has been, if gas is cheap, then we don't look at alternatives, or we really are slow at it, and it's not much going on. And I think we need some more incentive to do that, even if, you know, we start to become a little more oil independent, and or this Keystone Pipeline gets built from Canada, that, you know, just because gas suddenly is cheap again, let's keep working on other ideas and concepts out there that can, you know, relieve us from the need to have so much oil. And, hey, I was listening to Schmidt's show today just a little bit, very briefly, and he made a very good point. He said, since we're talking about energy companies here and investment, that kind of thing, he said, do you know who owns the big bad oil companies? Of course, he did a long, drawn-out thing of the big bad oil companies, the greedy oil companies, average Americans. Americans, because whether you're a stockholder, you know how many pensions, you know, Dick, you've got a pension from, is it the state of New York?
Minnesota, the county.
Yeah, just
Minnesota, I'm sorry. Okay.
Just look at your 401k.
Your pension may very well have invested money in oil companies, in oil stocks. It's very, very common. Many, many pensions have. So average Americans are making money and technically own the oil companies. So to demonize the oil companies, they're big bad, and we should tax them more, and we should just pick out the biggest five and tax them more. Selective taxation is tyranny. And those Americans that sit there and go, yeah, those big bad, there may be Americans out there whose pensions rely on the oil companies. And to slam the oil companies, one day they go to work and they get their annual little statement on their pension. They haven't retired yet. And it says, wow, why did my pension drop so much? Why hasn't, you know, changed much, the projections? Oh, because we went after those big bad oil companies. And sorry, but 50% of your pension was invested in the five top oil companies. Well, why was that a good thing to do? Then people start complaining. You know, everything we do has a...
I would like to comment on that, Tom. I was just reading an article in the paper today. Now, you're right. My pension does have money coming in from the oil companies. Also, I have stock invested, and some of that is in oil. However, I was reading an article in the paper today. It's very interesting. The oil companies themselves make a 7% profit. That is all.
Right.
The rest is all going to investors like you, me, and everybody else.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, their percentage is much less than. Yeah. Well, listen, do you know what the profit rate for Google is? It's 30%. That's the profit margin for Google, 30%. Hey, how come we're not going after the big bad Google? They're raking in way too much money. And what about Apple? Apple has got a 25% profit margin. Let's go after the big bad Apple. You know, Apple computer company. Man, they're bad. They're mean. They're a mean bad company because they make a 25% profit margin. But the oil companies, they're really bad and mean because they make a 7% profit margin. Yeah, and a lot of our pensions are invested in that. So yeah, you're right. And people need to wise up to this stuff. It's not about letting people see. We go after the big bad companies. And we always demonize. Find somebody to demonize. I tell you what, let's pick a strategic way to move forward in this country, and then start employing some quality tactics. And my recommendation is go after the big bad government. Government's profit margin on oil is huge. It's astronomical because of all the taxes that are placed on that. 1 gallon of oil might make, with the price of gasoline today, or 1 gallon of gasoline, might net the oil company and our pensions and everything else, at this point, the pricing maybe 20 cents. But that gallon is getting about 80, as much as 80 cents in some states, depending on what the state tax is along with the federal tax. So the federal government's the one that's profiting. The federal and state governments are profiting by oil. And you and I, Dick and Paula, we may be profiting a little bit, you know, getting a 2% return on our investments through the oil companies, but not as much as the federal government's getting.
Let me interrupt you, Tom. I have to go. Thank you and Paula for your time.
Oh, you're welcome, Dick.
Thanks for coming on, Dick.
Stay weekend.
You're welcome. You guys have a good weekend.
All right, we will. And you know what? I've been so busy flying this week. There's something that I should have mentioned today, and we're coming up on Memorial Day. And Paula, you always give a good shout out to our troops, et cetera. But let's take a moment to reflect on what Memorial Day is. But before we do that, I just want to close this out. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about today before the weekend?
Oh, I'm good. I think I'm all talked out.
Okay. All right. Well, first of all, let's think about why we support Memorial. Let me back up. Memorial Day weekend, this weekend at the Tyco Air Museum, I will be there helping celebrate Memorial and pay tribute to those that have gone before us and those that have fought and secured our liberty and fought tyranny around the world in various wars in the past. But it's an air museum, so it's focused on aviation, which is my love, and I will be there in my one of my original Navy flight suits, standing in front of airplanes like the F-14 or the F-18 or the A-4 or the F-16, the F-5, which I've all flown. And if you're in the area, come on by. It's a great open house. I haven't even seen the new hangar yet. We've got a new hangar dedicated to the Vietnam War Memorial. So look up the Tyco Air Museum in Titusville, Florida. It's actually between Titusville and Cocoa. That's why it's called the Tyco. Huh? Interesting. And come on by and say hello. I'll be there Saturday and Sunday. And it should be fun. So that we do that every year at the Air Museum, and we call it a Warbird Museum because that's what we've got, all military, pretty much all military aircraft. But no air show going on. They already did that back in March. But I'm going to read to you just a little bit about Memorial Day. Memorial Day is a United States federal holiday observed on the last Monday in May in 2011. It's May 30th, so 29th. Or 28th and 29th are the days I'm going to be there, and the actual Memorial Day I won't be there, but it will be open. It's formerly known as Decoration Day. It commemorates men and women who died while in military service to the United States. And so, you know, we can go all the way back to really the American Civil War and think about some of the people that, you know, died in the service of their country. So that's what it's about. It's how different is that from Veterans Day? Well, Veterans Day not only recognizes veterans that have given the ultimate sacrifice, but veterans that are still serving, veterans that are still alive. Memorial Day is focused on those that have died in the service of their country. So I don't think there's too many people argue with having a few holidays to recognize veterans, because we wouldn't be where we are today without their sacrifices. So in any case, happy Memorial Day. All you veterans out there, all of those serving, even though this is supposed to be focused on those that have gone before us and given the ultimate sacrifice, those of you that are serving, you raised your hand and said you would give the ultimate sacrifice. Those of you that served, you raised your hand and swore an oath that you would give the ultimate sacrifice if needed. So we thank you for all of that service, and I will give you the final word, Paula.
Well, Winston Churchill, do not let us speak of darker days. Let us speak rather of sterner days. These are not dark days. These are great days, the greatest days our country has ever lived. There are some dark days that have occurred in this country in the past couple of weeks, months, and years. We're going to approach a holiday weekend, and while you're out going to those white sales and enjoying your barbecues, remember your soldiers, remember your brothers, your fathers, your uncles, anyone that has served. You see somebody in a uniform, you thank them. I thank you for serving for our country and for our freedoms.
Well said. We're going to close on that. All right, everybody have a great, wonderful weekend. Paula, thanks. Great to see you again. Take care.
You're listening to The American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.